Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Hello, and welcome to the Tattered Cover. And I want to thank you all for coming tonight. And I also want to thank you for your support of Tattered Cover and other independent bookstores around the country. We're excited tonight to introduce you to Siobhan Fallon, who has received high praise for her new book, You Know When the Men Are Gone. Shortly after graduating from the New School in New York City with her MFA in creative writing, Siobhan met and married her husband, who is an Army major. While he served two tours of duty in Iraq, Siobhan lived at the Fort Hood Army Base in Texas. Her experience there led to these beautiful and haunting stories of what life is really like for those waiting for their soldiers to come home. Please help me welcome Siobhan Fallon.
Thank you for coming out tonight, and thank you so much, Marty, and everyone here at Tattered Cover has just been just phenomenal, and it's a wonderful indie bookstore, and I'm really honored to be invited to speak here tonight, so thank you. As Marty said, the collection of short stories are set at Fort Hood, where I was living when I wrote them, and while they're obviously fiction, I had two Iraq deployments and one Afghanistan deployment worth of material to sort of look back on and sort of pull out bits and pieces of things that I'd seen happen and like issues that arose again and again during deployment. So I had lots of interesting material, to say the least. And I'm going to be reading an excerpt from the title story, You Know When Men Are Gone. And it's about Natalia and Meg, two neighbors. And Meg, while her husband is in Iraq, develops, I don't want to say obsession, but she becomes overly curious about her neighbor Natalia, and she has a tendency to eavesdrop through their very thin army housing walls, and sort of in her mind is imagining what's going on in her neighbor's life as a way to avoid worrying about her own husband who's in Iraq. There is a sign at the main gate entrance, "Welcome to the great place, Fort Hood." Its greatness stretches for 340 square miles from the populated main cantonment of Fort Hood with its war-themed roads of Battalion Avenue, Hell on Wheels, Tank Destroyer, to its vast stretches of pitted firing ranges, the targets wavering with heat in the distance, soldiers slumped between the insufficient shade of tent netting, sipping from hot canteens. These ranges are notorious for being halted by cattle. Gates surround Hood, manned by men and women with firearms who check all vehicles and turn away anyone who does not have the proper identification. But Texas law will not banish the cows of neighboring farms from roaming the firing ranges. And soldiers wait hours and hours for the long-horned beasts to make their way out of the sights of their guns. Fort Hood, like most Army bases, has stern-faced offices with tiny windows, square apartment buildings and barracks with their crooked air conditioners and metal stairways, everything industrial in the ugliest way, with few architectural flourishes or decoration. Different bases might have different building materials, red brick versus gray concrete, depending on the wartime era of their construction, but it's always clear that no matter how much money Congress allotted for the Army budget, most of it went into the fighting machines rather than the buildings. When the soldiers deployed, when the 18,000 soldiers of the 1st Cav Division went to Iraq, the base shifted from a world dominated by camouflage uniforms to one of brightly colored baby carriages and diaper bags, mommy and me meetings at the 1st Cav Museum, women on pastel picnic blankets lounging on the parade fields, sharing cinnamon buns. Though a division of soldiers was far away, The retreat still sounded at 5 o'clock each evening, blared through speakers across the entire base, and the women stopped their moving cars and got out, stood in the streets with their hands over their hearts, facing the flag, just as their husbands would have done until the bugle song was over. Wives with lawns quickly learn to mow them or hire the neighbor's teenage son lest they get a military police citation for letting the grass grow too long. The spouses admired each other's flower beds, their unit crest banners that they hung over the name tag doors, the small American flags that they pressed into the edges of their driveways, the yellow ribbons they tied around the trees out front. They shopped together, shared leftovers, watched each other's kids so they could go to the gym. They attended church and Bible study, baked brownies and mailed them to soldiers, washed cars to raise money for school supplies for Afghani and Iraqi children. The women tried to reach out to Natalia. They really did. They invited her to playgroups and luncheons and teas. They offered to babysit her children so she could have a break. And all along, they were afraid of her. They knew that she could happen to any of them. She could be the girl cutting their husband's hair right now in Baghdad, shipped in from some economically devastated country, young and lovely and, for goodness sake, a woman in that place of men. Who wouldn't fall in love with such a girl when he was so far from home and so close to death? A woman's soft hands along the short ridge of his hair, on his sunburned neck, holding the mirror up for him to see his reflection next to hers. But Natalia never accepted any of the invitations. With her dog Boris tugging her wildly, she walked around Hood in that coat you could spot a mile away, her earrings glinting, her lips perfectly painted, making all the other wives assess their figures in the mirror or tuck at their shirts self-consciously, touching their hair, rubbing powder into their sweat-shiny faces, knowing it was no use. This is what they knew and whispered about Natalia. She didn't bake or make posters. She never offered to wash a car. She didn't take her children to the parks on post. She shopped at the commissary and filled her cart with odd foods, cabbage and onions and potatoes, maybe a chocolate milk or ice cream, but never anything nutritious enough to feed a pair of three-year-olds. She went out a few nights a week, dressed to cause a scandal, high heels, plenty of rouge, earrings long enough to touch her collarbones. She went out alone, and if the wives met her on the stairs and tried to ask her where she was headed at 10 o'clock at night, she would smile as if she didn't understand the question and continue tottering down to the parking lot below. No one ever saw a babysitter enter her apartment, even though plenty of wives had volunteered, eager to get a look at the interior of her home and refrigerator. They had all seen Natalia lock the door behind her when she went out, and they imagined those children of hers inside with the television on, alone, the apartment's sharp corners waiting for their soft heads. But no one ever called family services. Instead, they thought of her soldier husband coming home to discover his children gone. One night, there was a knock on Meg's door. Natalia stood outside, moving from foot to foot as if her high heels hurt her. For a moment, Meg thought Natalia was going to ask her to go out with her, that they would go to some underground Serbian bar and drink vodka martinis while strange men watched them from the shadows. Instead, Natalia handed Meg the three crumpled $20 bills she owed her. Meg took the money and hesitated, waiting, but Natalia just stared as if she wanted a receipt. She was wearing an orange lipstick that made her cheeks a little gray. Meg smiled through her disappointment and said softly, "I could watch your children for you. I only work days, and I could watch them at night. That way they wouldn't be alone in case something happened." The skin of Natalia's pale neck turned red, but Meg couldn't tell if it was anger or embarrassment. "A woman must go out sometimes, yes?" Natalia asked softly. "Husbands do not understand. The babies sleep, nothing will happen. It's common in my country. We do not worry so much." Meg folded the money in a back pocket. "Still, I could watch them." "Perhaps," Natalia said, lifting her shoulder slightly in annoyed acquiescence. Before Meg could nod in reply, Natalia turned away. Before Jeremy left, he and Meg had talked about having children. She smiled and blinked and told him soon, and then ran to the bathroom and checked that she'd taken her birth control pill that day. She was 28. It was time to think about procreation, and yet Jeremy's long absences were hard enough to bear without children. She just managed to get through each day, brush her teeth, go to work, feed her body, sleep. If it was almost impossible for her to live half a life without the man who was supposed to share all of it, How could she be both father and mother to some unfinished and needy little being? There were days when she imagined going to California, a place of escape with its beaches and wineries, mountains and fog. She could get a job in an art gallery in one of those dreamy, gentle-named coastal towns, Monterey, Carmel by the Sea, Big Sur. She'd start over, find a man who was always there, who could take normal vacations, have weekends off, call in sick, accompany her to her cousin's wedding, her uncle's wake. She wanted to worry about ordinary things, like whether her husband forgot his lunch or got a bonus, not that he might get shot or that he'd be crossing a street in Baghdad and never get to the other side. She carried this worry with her night and day. It pulled at her legs and shoulders and tear ducts, always there and ready to consume her. Because how could anyone think rationally about a spouse in a war zone? And when Jeremy, late at night those few weeks before he left, had cupped her body against his, kissing her belly and longing to fill it up with his child, she thought only of the worry already growing there. She wondered if her belly could carry a life as well, if there was space for both, and if the worry would form a stone pillow for her baby's head. Would it leach into the baby's bones and blood and tiny cells? Now she thought of Natalia and those eerie-eyed twins of hers, whispering a Serbian pidgin in a language only they could understand. Perhaps Natalia nursed a ghostly worry, too. Perhaps her twins remembered another in their mother's womb, the three of them waiting to be born. And then the night before the homecoming for the soldiers, Natalia does end up dropping her, or asking Meg to watch her children. So, Natalia's children were every bit as good as she had promised they would be, playing quietly with a set of wooden blocks, then going to bed as soon as Meg led them to their little room. Of course, Meg crept all over Natalia's apartment, especially in the bedroom. The bed was perfectly made, the walls a somber green, the bedspread a shocking white. There were no family photos on the walls or bureaus, none of Natalia holding twin infants at the hospital, no wedding photos and no scenes of Serbia. A luminous icon of Jesus, his beard as black as his wet eyes, hung directly over the bed. Meg thought of Natalia in this dark-walled room and understood why she would resist bringing her nightly male visitor here. But he had been here the night before. Hadn't Meg heard him? He had finally wormed his way into Natalia's bed. Meg peered at the pale comforter, looking for something sordid, the lacy edge of see-through panties, perhaps, and she wondered why Natalia could not have waited just a little bit longer for her soldier husband to come home. Then Meg went out to the living room, turned on the TV, and thought of Natalia's husband, how, like all of the others, he was sitting on a plane right now, so excited to return to the States, to his home, to his family. The wives had ensured that his dog and his children had not been taken from him by family services, but Meg knew that his wife had. She knew he would not be returning to a happy home. Leaning back into the pillows of the couch, Meg kicked off her shoes. Soon she wouldn't need to worry about Natalia. Tomorrow, her husband Jeremy would be home. That interminable waiting, waiting, waiting for her life to continue. Such a long gray nothingness between departure and return. Huge chunks of her existence filled up and pushed through as if it were a task rather than a stretch of her young life. There was such unreality to the waiting, such limbo. Sometimes she didn't even know what she was waiting for. All that wasted time. Time was the enemy, waking her up at night alone and ticking so slowly, every minute mocking her. But now it was over. Jeremy would be back tomorrow, and her life would resume, and she would no longer care what Natalia did within these walls. Thank you. All right, Q&A? Yes, Robin.
I wanted to know what happened to these people.
Mm. Do you know what happened to these people? Yeah. Oh, the question was, do I know what happens to the characters once the story finishes? And I do, but I don't know if I should tell anybody. I always like to hear what people think. And then I just sort of smile, and I don't know. It infuriates my mother, who has her own idea of every single, I don't know, the next 5 years for everybody. But, yeah, I don't know. Do you want to know? Or do you like to think?
No,
yeah. All right, I'll leave it up to all of you then. That's good. Yes, sir.
How long did you live at Fort Hood?
The question was how long I lived at Fort Hood, and we lived there almost 3.5 years, from 96 to the summer of 99.
Is your husband still in the service, may I ask?
Yes, my husband is still in, and he'll probably be in until he retires. I think he's a lifer. Yeah.
So where are you living now, man?
Okay. I'm living out of a suitcase in my mom's house in New York, but we're on our way to Jordan, to Amman, Jordan. And my husband's actually there right now, and I'm going to meet him when things settle a little and when he has to unpack and set up the house for once. So then my daughter and I will join him.
What was that like when the psychologist went on the tirade, the shooting?
The question was, what was Fort Hood like during the shootings, the recent shootings in November? I wasn't there, thank God. But yeah, I got a lot of phone calls from friends who were there. And the Army has this very circular way of moving people, and they have a tendency, once your soldiers come home, that they will pick you up and send you to the next base, like almost every 3 years or so. So most of the people that my husband served with and the spouses I knew were scattered all over, but some people were still there. So there's a lot of frantic telephone calls, seeing who was where and if everybody was okay. And I didn't know anyone who was hurt or killed in that, so... What role infidelity plays in the military, or how often it occurs? I think it probably happens as often as it happens anywhere else or in the rest of society. But we live so close together, and the soldiers are always training together and staying, you know, in the same barracks. And so I think once the hint of it has escaped, like, people know, and it, so it seems like it happens more often just because you're so aware of it. And and that so many young soldiers, you know, that might not have the same solid basis to they might be married for less time than they're deployed, so I don't know if they have the stability that they would have had if they didn't deploy. So it seems like a more common occurrence probably than it actually is compared to the rest of society. Sorry. Yes, Ted.
I was wondering, are there any books that you're familiar with that people like yourself have done similar types of writing from another war era, like maybe World War II or so on, and have kind of a comparable fiction book? I'm kind of curious how people have seen different times. If they're at all similar, if these stories are kind of, you know, the different names, different locations, but people do kind of maybe the same things under these types of circumstances.
Yeah. Ted's question was if there are other books that are in the similar vein from other wartime eras. If anybody knows, please tell me, because I really haven't found any. I mean, I found some other military spouses who are writing right now, and I've been reading their memoirs more than, doesn't seem like as much fiction as out at the moment, but I would love to see if it's a similar experience. And so please send me an email and let me know.
I'm just wondering, when you decided to write about this experience, my experience in the Army back in the 60s was that my life was on hold for 3 years. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be looking introspectively at the experience. I was looking to get away from it ultimately. I wasn't on life. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that somebody like yourself, with your education, would even kind of in the military choose to write about it. I'm just, what did you know almost immediately this is something you wanted to write about, or was there kind of a trigger? It kind of got you started and started you moving. What might that have been?
I don't know if there was an exact trigger to what got me writing about these themes, but I was living in Fort Hood, and my husband had deployed and just come back from a deployment, and already we knew he was having to get ready for another and starting the training almost from the moment he got back. So it was writing what I knew, and I just wrote that first story that I read an excerpt from was the first, you know, I started with that, and just that concept of eavesdropping and the things you do to distract yourself when, you know, you're worried about your soldier and you're wondering what everyone else is doing. And it sort of spun all of these other characters out that I just kept writing about.
So you mentioned your mother. What about your husband? I assume he's read your stories.
Yes, my husband has been a fabulous editor for me. And he, my military expert, and checking any dialogue that comes out of a man's mouth, he has, like, edited 10 times, and especially what the soldiers say, because I was so off in the beginning. And, yeah, he's been amazing. And he never said, don't write that, or I'm going to get in trouble. Like, he just focused on the fiction and has been just really supportive and smart. Yes, sir.
Why is Fort Hood when somebody doesn't come back?
Fort Hood, when there's a casualty, is really, I mean, what can you say? Incredibly sad. And you, of course, the flags are at half mast, and everybody goes to the memorial service. And one of the Army support systems, they have a care team, so they have spouses and who are trained to help out the family that has suffered that death. I mentioned a little bit in one of these stories, we refer to somebody who's lost a soldier in combat as a Gold Star family, and they have certain, you know, certain rights as a Gold Star family, you know, and the Army tries to take care of them. So, yeah. Ma'am? I'm reading Peter Carey's Parrot and Olivier. I just started that. Of course, I just finished Jonathan Franzen's newest. Ben Percy's The Wilding that came out a couple months ago.
Do you find yourself influenced by that reading, or are you able to kind of partition that off of where you are in terms of your style and approach to writing?
I was definitely influenced by Ben Percy's collection of short stories that came out a few years ago, Refresh, Refresh. And he's got a story that's just remarkable, the title story about a bunch of teenagers whose fathers have all deployed. And I thought it was amazing, and it definitely made me think, okay, somebody might actually want to read my fiction. And I liked how he made it not ordinary, but just dealing with the normal day-in, day-out drama of a life instead of the soldier. I liked how he turned it on the family. So, okay.
Would you like to sign some books?
I would love to sign books. Thank you.
We'll
thank
have
you.
To sit here.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.